I'll open it up, and I'll probably take, you know, 3 to 5 comments or questions, your choice, from everybody who's here, and then we'll have a chance for those who prepared presentations to respond, and we'll have a discussion. So, sound good? Okay, so let's dive into it. At my left here is Professor Jackie Stevens, who is a professor of political science at Northwestern University. Please give her a welcome. And sitting to her left is Lucille Eckridge, who is a professor at Illinois State University. Right. So please welcome Lucille. And sitting to her left is a fellow Wisconsinite who is a professor here at Metropolitan University. That's right. Nicholas Hartla. So please welcome. I'm the only one who's not a professor. I'm a graduate student in sociology, nearing the end of my research term at University of California, Santa Barbara. And this is not my primary area of work as an academic. I study constitutionalism and social movements, but I have a particular interest in higher education, being somebody who's a professional. So that's where this is coming from. And I basically offered to start us off to frame the conversation. I have a feeling we're going to be talking primarily about higher education and not so much K-12 tonight, but the more that we can get into K-12, the better, and maybe that will come up in the discussions here. What I want to share is, in part, an analysis that's not my own. I've borrowed it from Leonard Minsky and David Noble, and probably they borrowed it from some others, but it starts with a piece of legislation that was enacted in 1979. That was one of the, if not the last, statutes that was enacted by President Jimmy Carter, right? It's the Bayh-Dole Act. It's named for Evan Bayh and Bob Dole, right? I'm sometimes quoted as saying that, you know, the worst two words in the English language are bipartisan consensus. The way I actually tend to put it is just watch out if you see bipartisan consensus, because that's what this legislation was. It was a bipartisan consensus that found Jimmy Carter's signature, sadly, that came out of the Business Roundtable in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And what it does, and what it did, and what it does is it allows universities that receive federal funding to engage in contracts with private interests, almost always large corporations, in which the corporation can get the full proprietary interest in research produced without having borne the cost, right, of producing that research. So what this essentially did was it opened what, over the course of the 1980s and especially in the 1990s, became a floodgate of the corporatization of university research. I became aware of this in part because of Noble and Minsky's work, but also because my undergraduate work was primarily in the College of Agriculture at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. I was in rural sociology, reason social, I won't explain sort of technical issues there, but primarily based in rural sociology. And our college was one of the first to be affected in a very major way. Monsanto Corporation came to our college and said, we have a problem with our Roundup herbicide, and the problem is that there's resistance that's being developed to this herbicide, and we need to make it possible for farmers to be able to apply more and more Roundup to their crops without killing them. Right. So the University of Wisconsin developed, on behalf of Monsanto, Roundup Ready soybeans, and Monsanto paid a pittance of the overall cost. They didn't pay for physical plants, they didn't pay the faculty salaries for the most part, but they didn't pay most of the expenses that were involved in developing this product for Monsanto. I heard some gasps, because I think that there are people in this room and people who are watching elsewhere who are aware that that it wasn't really necessarily in the public interest to develop this product, right? That developing genetically engineered plants that are more resistant to poison is not really a solution, not a long-term solution. In fact, it's actually a problem. And so there's a reaction that says, our university shouldn't even be used for producing this kind of research. But it goes much deeper than that. The corporatization of university research at a major land-grant institution like the University of Wisconsin, one of the largest universities in the world, and I say that having just come back from UNAM, where, you know, and from Mexico City, where Jackie and I met for the first time, but still, UW is a pretty big place. It drives a lot of other things. It drives the internal marketization of each campus and each university. So, you know, we had a land tenure center that was well funded in the College of Agriculture. Still sort of have, which was focused on sustainability and indigenous agriculture and finding ways for people to be able to raise crops and sustain communities without pesticides and herbicides, right? That's not able to attract funding from the Monsantos of the world, right? So the priorities within the College of Agriculture began to shift. And the Land Tenure Center loses a lot of its funding and its support, and you see sort of a rush in terms of priorities within the College of Agriculture, within engineering, within physics, within a lot of the so-called hard sciences, or really the physical sciences, right? Physical and natural sciences. That also has an impact within the university, which is that there are other fields which are less well-placed to capture corporate funding, even if they wanted it. Right? Now, the Department of Sociology, Social Work, Education, Chicano Studies, African American Studies, American Indian Studies, Women's Studies, History, probably less interested in pursuing corporate financing, but they're now in a situation that is enabled by Dole and other pressures to where they are competing within the university structure to be able to prove that they can find this 15 to 20% outside funding that will then leverage more dollars, right? So it's had an effect, it's an internal marketization effect. And you can see that effect at other institutions that have lost departments of sociology and social work and education. I mean, I believe the department, this is not just in the public sector schools, but also private. I believe the University of Chicago education school was downgraded, right, in this period. And, you know, this is the school of John Dewey, right? So, you know, a great pragmatist and education theorist and reformer, right? So it has that kind of effect within each entity of higher education. It also has an effect within systems of higher education. So other system schools in Wisconsin, for example, began to try to compete with UW-Madison, UW-Oshkosh, UW-Stevens Point, UW-Richland Center, a little tiny two-year institution, right? They're all in the same race for outside money, right? And that's a, sort of a big part of the picture. So I would argue that the analysis that Bayh-Dole was sort of a pivotal sort of act in driving the corporatization of university research, and that that in turn has driven a lot of other things in terms of changing priorities, not only within individual institutions, but within the higher education sector in general, is correct, right? And that it has actually driven the increase in tuition as well, right? So the priority becomes on, you know, building new facilities, so-called edifice complex, as we call them, for the institution. That's John Peck, he's here elsewhere doing a session, so I won't take credit for it. But yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, we need a bright new shining building. We need to, you know, expand, you know, in certain sectors. That requires more funding than corporations are providing. That money has to come from somewhere. When it comes from somewhere at a time in which state aid to public education is declining in relative terms compared to the cost, right, then the cost ends up being borne by students and their families, right? And so it's no surprise to me that in a period in which you have the rising corporatization of university research, and in which you've had, for example, in the University of Wisconsin system, a decline from 61% state support of the public university system to less than 10%. And that's from Kathy Lyle, the former head of the UW system, the former president, who is now a lobbyist for big corporations, among other things. Yeah, they don't call it, she's a public higher education scholar, sorry. But when you see that declining state funding for public higher education and you see increasing costs that are driven through the corporatization of research, you get skyrocketing tuition. Okay? This has taken place at the same time. Give you a chance there. All right, here we go. That's taken place at the same time that Of course, you've had declining aid for students in the form of financial aid. So in 1979, this year, which in many ways was a high point for American civilization, and I tell my undergraduate students when I give this lecture that I don't mean that in terms of access to soft drugs. And I don't mean that even in terms of Jefferson Starship, which was better than people think it was. It was a high point in terms of increasing access for women and people of color and low-income people to getting into institutions of higher learning. It was a high point in terms of the actual cost, the share of a low-income family, a poor family's family income, and how much they'd have to shell out to pay for tuition. 1979 was the best year. Since then, what you've seen is that instead of having students getting $2 in federal scholarships for every $1 in loans, you've seen not only the reversal of that, but now it's actually $1 in scholarships for every $3 in loans, right? So you've seen a shift in terms of how students are actually paying for tuition, right? Get real, nobody's doing this with their summer jobs and their night jobs, no. Right? It's not happening. The other piece of the puzzle here that I just want to address is the role of public support for public higher education. When I say public support, I mean financial support. And we have to be, I think, very careful here, because a lot of times there's a tendency to fall into the trap of believing the narrative that the reason why public tax dollars don't adequately support public higher education anymore is that the people of the state of Minnesota or Wisconsin or Nevada or California, whichever state you happen to live in, don't support public universities, right? The polling doesn't show that, right? It doesn't show that at all, right? Public support for public higher education, particularly for access to public higher education, remains very high. But what has gone down is the poor proportion of public tax dollars that go to support public higher education. And the reason for that, I think, is very clear. I should be talking about this in the next section later today, so I won't dwell on it. But it's that the Chamber of Commerce, primarily, is in there every day lobbying and buying legislators. And they outgun students and parents and community members when it comes to having influence over state budget priorities. Now, there are times when that is, we win a round, right? This is sort of a matter of a simple sort of austerity agenda that's naked self-interest, right? We just want more money for our clients who are big businesses, not small businesses, but big corporations. And so, this is a way for us to steal from the poor to give to the rich, right? But there's also an ideological agenda that's involved here. And it's an ideological agenda that actually does have its roots back with Bayh-Dole in the 1970s and with the identification of access to higher education as a problem by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, and other major corporate sort of think tanks and interests here in the United States, where they basically came out with a plan for restructuring higher education in the United States. And that is the plan that they have been implementing through their state affiliates for my entire life. I was born in 1974, right? This is the story of my life in some ways. So that's just an analysis that I wanted to sort of present. There's more to it than that. There have been a whole series of struggles around global policy and higher education. In the 1990s, I and my confederates in the student movement at that time worked with faculty and with teachers' unions and others to build a tri-national coalition that was part of a global coalition against the inclusion of education as a service in the General Agreement on Trade and Services, the GATS, which was a side agreement. And we actually won that round, right? We won the round for a variety of reasons in Seattle in 1999 against the World Trade Organization, so it was a side agreement to the WTO negotiations. But the reality is that education remains in the crosshairs globally as well as domestically. As systems of higher education in the United States are part of a global system of education that is under assault. For that reason, it's been important that in the last 25 years in particular, students and faculty and staff and people in the United States have been linking up more and more with movements against the corporatization of education, or the neoliberal sort of structural adjustment programs that are being implemented all around the world. So there's a whole history to that organizing that I think most of us, even in this room, are probably not aware of, but it has been important. It was important in the days leading up to the Wisconsin Uprising. It was important in the days leading up to Occupy Wall Street, and it's one of the reasons why those uprisings actually proliferated. They came in from Europe and from Chile and Latin America and from Thailand and from Ghana and so on, and then they went back out again. That's a cut and dry presentation there. I hope it was helpful, and I'm going to ask Jackie Stevens, professor of political science at Northwestern University, to come up. And we were talking a little bit earlier to present what I think is one of the most important case studies and actual struggles that are going on right now dealing with the polarization of higher education.
It really is a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Ben for inviting me. We really met in a very happenstance way a couple months ago at a conference, the Law Society conference in Mexico City, and realized that we had a bunch of overlapping interests. Ben just didn't mention it, that he's working toward a PhD, but he already has a law degree, was a practicing attorney, and then he's gone back and getting his PhD. And I'm someone who has a PhD, but I've been, you know, increasingly very engaged in trying to develop my own and others' legal literacy in order to engage with problems of the university. And I teach at Northwestern University. I've taught at a bunch of other institutions. I'm a full professor there. And I'm laughing because last year, in response to my speech and analysis, including what I'm about to share with you today, the administration banned me from campus and claimed that I was psychotic and a threat to students. And they tried to fire me. You can read about it. There's a website called brandnu.world, which was kind of self-amusing. And I go through that there. And since then, there's been, they let me back. I mean, there's a whole, I won't go into the details of that, but I will talk about the backstory to it. So Northwestern has an interesting profile. I, as I mentioned, taught at a number of institutions previously, and I've never been at a place, I taught at liberal arts colleges, I taught at public universities, I taught in Istanbul, and I've never been at a place that seemed so corporate. And I was trying to figure out what was going on, like what was in the DNA of the place that made it different from other institutions. And one of the things that was confounding from the very beginning was that I couldn't figure out what their governance documents were. So I was trying to figure out, like, what are the rules that go into who's a trustee and so forth. And those were actually, I had to pay $23 to the state of Illinois to get a copy of the university charter, because at that time they didn't post it on the website. Since I started poking around, now it is a publicly available document. And so what I want to do in narrating this is try to highlight some details that might be helpful to other people when you're trying to figure out what's going on in your institution. So one of the things I think is very important is figuring out what the organizing documents are and what the governance structure is in order to figure out who has power. So at Northwestern, actually most universities, well, private universities, it's the trustees. So who are the trustees? Well, again, at Northwestern, that was and still is obscure unless you go to look at their 990. So there's a long list of people who are supposedly their trustees, but only a small portion of those are the actual voting members, and they don't distinguish who those are on the website. So the only way to figure that out, maybe, is what's on their 990. There's really no way to check as to what the accuracy of the information that they include on their 990 and who really is, but maybe that's this group of people. So while I was trying to figure, while I was sorting this out, I also was trying to figure out why Northwestern had a campus in Qatar. So Northwestern is based in Chicago. It's pretty far to Qatar. They don't have a campus in, you know, like they have a campus in downtown Chicago, but they don't have anything in the south side. Why Qatar? And so then I looked at the other universities who were also in Qatar, and they all had what these features in common, which are that they have historical ties to the national security state. And if you want to learn more about the research in this and some citations, there's an article that I published called Forensic Intelligence and the Deportation Research Clinic Toward a New Paradigm. And you can find that in other documents either on my website, jacquelinestevens.org, or I direct the Deportation Research Clinic at Northwestern, and there's links there to this stuff as well. And this was published in a journal called Perspectives on Politics, which is the of the American Political Science Association, and there's a lot of footnotes to the information I'm about to share with you. So to make a long story short, the universities that are, historically, since the 1950s, the United States has assured foreign countries access to either scholarships in the United States or university campuses in these other countries in exchange either for military bases or for weapons trade. And it's called offset trade. It's called defense offset trade. And there's an actual part of the U.S. government that monitors this. There's like data on it. It's part of the Bureau of Industry and Security, which is within the Department of Commerce. And the first campus with which I was able to get details about this arrangement involving Northwestern was from 1971. And that was the Azori Island Base Agreement, where the State Department made arrangements for scholarships to students for teaching colleges for students from Portugal to go to the University of Texas and to Columbia College and to Northwestern. And there's documents that I obtained through WikiLeaks that say, they talk about the arrangements for screening the students, and they say, you can come talk to the students. This is a cable from the State Department to the Portuguese government, their higher education, saying we'll make arrangements for the administrators to come speak with students during the Easter conference, provided the smoke screen is thick enough.
Oh my goodness!
So anyway, going forward. What I focused on at Northwestern is the fact that the board of Northwestern is actually run by defense contractors. And so when the students come to me and they're talking about divestment, and they're saying like, oh, we shouldn't invest in Caterpillar and so forth, I'm laughing because I'm telling them, you know what, it's not like we're investing in them. They own us. So the chair of Northwestern's board of trustees is a director for Caterpillar, and also for General Dynamics. There are several members of the Board of Trustees, the Board of Directors for General Dynamics, who are on Northwestern's board. The family that founded General Dynamics is the Crown family. Henry Crown first ran something called Material Services and then turned that into General Dynamics, which is one of the world's largest military contractors. And several of the Crown family members are on Northwestern's board. The former CEO of General Dynamics is on Northwestern's board. The current CEO of General Dynamics is on Northwestern's board. And then the same thing for Boeing. So the husband of the CEO for General Dynamics is a lobbyist for Boeing. And the past chair of the board for Boeing is on Northwestern's board. So if you look at what these offset arrangements are, it's an edge that military companies have when they're trying to negotiate against, say, Airbus, right? And so what countries really like is if they can send their kids or if they, to a US campus, or if they can get the campus there. And so these companies brag, and again, the citations are in the article that I just referenced, so they brag about how they're able to set up these contracts with these foreign governments because of these offset arrangements. And it's not just education, there's a lot of other ones. But it's a large, these offset arrangements, and this is, since we're not just talking about education here, but larger democratic control, the offset arrangements are about 60% of the military contracts. Like, that's what they're valued at. There's over $100 billion worldwide of these offset arrangements are used for defense trade. And the reason that you think, like, why are they doing that and not just, like, bidding based on dollar amounts or something like that? And it's because there are certain kinds of edges that the U.S. has when it comes to technology or when it comes to education, and that gives our military firms an edge in these negotiations. But there's all sorts of weird stuff that they can do. So, for example, a firm will say, okay, well, we'll guarantee credit for your corn exporters in exchange for buying General Electric refrigeration units or something like that. And it it's a way of, it's a pseudo or quasi-legal way of escaping foreign, the Corruption Act reporting requirements. And the firms that do these offset arrangements brag about that, that it's a way of evading transparency. But it's actually anti-capitalist because it also is a way of you know, being able to evade monetization of certain kinds of trade. I do a lot of FOIA litigation, and so I filed a request. So there are these reports. You can look them up at the Bureau of Industry and Security. It's called Defense Offset Trade. And so I asked for the underlying data that went into the production of the reports. And you know, so for instance, like for 1 year, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars for higher education, right? So this isn't nothing. And so I asked for the underlying data, and I just got back like a whole bunch of blacked out pages. But the thing is, like, it's going to be interesting to litigate it because U.S. policy opposes this kind of trade, and it says that it's against, you know, it says that Congress passed a law in the 90s saying it's against public policy to pursue this trade, and at the beginning of the report, it says it is against policy to pursue this trade. Nonetheless, firms report is very difficult for them to operate without this trade, and so it's kind of like, you know, I mean, it's a little bit bizarre that they can get away with that, right? Like just going like, oh, it's hard for us to run our business without, you know, like taking, like smoking marijuana in the workplace. Like our employees are very bored, so we need to smoke a lot of pot. You couldn't get away with that. So it's a little bit strange that they're able to be so overt about violating this kind of law. So going back to Northwestern, what are the effects there? So there's a whole bunch of effects down the line, and they range everything from the very big picture in terms of the distortions that they have on our foreign policy and what's going on in Qatar, that it gives this smokescreen of legitimacy and to these governments, it gives them access to prestige and to physically coming to the United States and having contact with people at very high levels. Qatar is part of the forces that were led by Saudi Arabia that are bombing Yemen. They're using cluster bombs that were sold to Saudi Arabia by General Dynamics. General Dynamics is banned from the list of portfolios of a number of countries and some universities. And meanwhile, they literally are running Northwestern, and you know their weapons are being used in this way. The cluster bombs are from earlier purchases. I don't know. They've been a little bit more savvy about hiding it right now, but there were cluster bombs that were used in Yemen recently. They were produced by General Dynamics. And so this, you know, the Qatar was part of the forces that were dropping them. I could go on and on about the other kinds of, you know, ties between Northwestern and these other states as well. In the next session, I'll talk about how to get information about this if you're interested in hearing more. At Northwestern, the effect of this is really horrifying. As I said, the reason I got involved was I couldn't figure out why the university was so corporate, and you know, there's all these centers for leadership and for business, and you know, there are opportunity costs, and this goes back to what Ben was talking about. Like, why don't we have centers for citizenship studies? Why do we have such a disproportionate emphasis on management and all of these other programs? Who is making those decisions? And so partly it's because of these trustees, and partly it's because of the independence of the administration from normal accountability because of all the funding that they're getting from these from Qatar. So Qatar gave Northwestern about $40 million for last year for the Qatar campus. It's 200 students. So that's like $200,000 a student, which is higher than Amherst spends on its students. So what's going on with that money? And partly what it's doing is it's keeping the university and certain people insulated from accountability as to what's actually going on in our programming. What we're doing at Northwestern as part of the liberal arts piece of things is, like, I feel like it's window dressing for all of these other operations. It's a very small part of the budget, which they won't disclose, but this is kind of back of the envelope calculations. And so I'll stop here. If you have any questions, we can talk further. The way to address, there's two ways to address this, and one is through faculty mobilizing and standing up to them. And I want to give one quick hopeful story, which is that Last year, the faculty mobilized against an effort to appoint a retired lieutenant general who didn't have a PhD to run the Buffett Institute for Global Studies. And when I got wind of it early, and the normal way that Northwestern does things is that they just announce things as a fait accompli, but because we figured this out early, I got in touch with some colleagues who were part of the Buffett Institute. And first we wrote, and I'm going through this in a little bit of detail because it worked. So first we wrote a letter to the university. It was a very polite letter saying, hey, we think that you're considering this guy who's unqualified to run a research center. We'd like you to reconsider, and we'd at least like to have him out to campus to give a public talk. And then they said, like, fuck you, and no, we don't want to do that. And then we did a public letter. And again, they said, like, no, like, go away. And then we did a petition. And the reason I'm saying that we, you know, going through all of these steps is that escalating it was really good PR. It helped build our momentum early on so that people understood that we were trying to go through the channels, and it wasn't just like, oh, like we're going to have a sit-in right away, right? So we're trying to approach them in a collegial fashion and then documenting how they blow us off at each step. And so after the petition got going, then it got some press, and we also went through the Faculty Senate. And the Faculty Senate wasn't immediately useful in terms of a vote, but it was a way of galvanizing press interest. And to make a longer story short, Eikenberry became so embarrassed by the whole thing that he actually withdrew. And the university had lied to him and made it seem as though everybody was on board, there were no problems, and they'd also hidden from him the fact that there was this early opposition. So they didn't tell him that in like last September we had written this letter. And when he came out later, they still kept that hidden from him. So anyway, I just want to end with that story. And then the final thing is on the bigger stage, how this could be addressed. We really need to have laws passed by our state legislatures that require the same transparency of private nonprofits that is required of public universities. Mm-hmm. And because that, right now, they're able to use the nonprofit structure as a way to obscure that what they do in a way that they couldn't do even with a corporation. And so governments have to be subject to the Records Act requests, and corporations also have to have filings. A number of these people I just mentioned are targeted for lawsuits for violating their fiduciary responsibility at their companies. And it's pretty clear to me that those kinds of documents, were they public, would be useful for having faculty and other members of the university community also holding them accountable. And so if people are in Illinois and want to work with me on this, I'd really like to speak with you, so let me know.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming up on short notice. Learned a lot the second time around that I heard about what you've been doing. Our next presenter is Professor Nicholas Hartlett, who is at the Metropolitan State University. I misspoke earlier. I think I also said good evening to you, so that tells you the state of mind I'm in right now. But please welcome Professor Hartlett up here.
I'm going to sit, and I hope you don't fall asleep because we just had lunch. So I'm just going to keep my remarks. I'm going to read excerpts from our book with my colleague Lucille Eckrich. And the reason for it is because we spent so much damn time with the words. I think we got it right. And I don't want to get off track. So coming from Ben's presentation to Jackie's by Dole and what's going on at Northwestern and other universities, what I'd like to add to today's conversation is the vocabulary that we're using in higher education, which underpins some of the ideology that corporations have infiltrated and really are setting the agenda. So the book is The Neoliberal Agenda in the Student Debt Crisis in U.S. Higher Education. So I'm going to talk about with you for a moment the $1.4 trillion problem and set that in context, because that's a huge sum of money, but I'll alert you to some contextual facts that might make you gasp. So why this book? In 2013, Lucille, my good friend here, and I wrote an article entitled Ivory Tower Graduates in the Red, The Role of Debt in Higher Education, which was published in the Canadian journal Workplace, a journal for academic labor. In our co-authored article, I shared personal experiences of incurring a great amount of student debt while earning my BS, MS, and PhD. As this book goes to press, two recently minted PhD colleagues, Collier and Brewer, they contributed pieces, are currently without tenure track positions. These individuals, just as I did, invested their time, talents, and money into earning a terminal degree. As a millennial myself, an older one, I guess there's a new word, exennial. I'm an exennial. Whatever I am, I'm 33.
Solidarity.
Committing treason, I'm wearing Green Bay in Minnesota. Student loan debt is as much a personal research interest as a professional one. It's personal because in many respects, the economy I've inherited presents prospects worse than my parents faced. It is professional because I'm privileged enough to have a tenure-track position at Metro State, which affords me the opportunity to pursue and publish research. I was interested in editing this book of capitalist counter-stories and context pieces due to the fact that many, like me in the millennial generation, are ninjas. They have no income, no jobs, or assets. As a Christian, I've read in Proverbs 17:16, it does a fool no good to spend money on an education because he has no common sense. In times past, pursuit of a college degree was the sensible thing to do, and one could do so without getting into too much debt. The practice is becoming more difficult in the current times. In fact, some, like Melissa Del Rio in this book, are concluding that it is financially foolish to go to college. I'm also reminded of the precarious words of Jim Mars, who in his 2011 book, The Trillion Dollar Conspiracy, wrote the following, and I quote, "Free people can travel anywhere at any time they like. They can start a business or a new profession or even take a vacation for as long as they wish. One sure way to create a slave is to ensure a person is indebted. After all, anyone who cannot do any of the things a free person can do because he or she has a mortgage, bills of all sorts, and the need for a monthly paycheck should be considered a slave of sorts, a debt slave." This book is needed because student debt slavery is foreclosing freedom from the millennial generation, replacing it with a future of mortgage-sized debt payments. The millennial generation has no surplus income because the bulk of whatever they have goes to repaying their student loans. Many don't have jobs, and this doesn't only pertain to those who want to be in the ivory tower. It also includes students who have an undergraduate degree and those who managed to accumulate debt but didn't get a college degree. Finally, the millennial generation doesn't have the assets like homes because they cannot save enough for a down payment. They live paycheck to paycheck, paying their debts. I've reached the midpoint of the 10-year public student loan forgiveness program, which we know Donald Trump and Betsy DeVos want to cut. And I have hope that all of my student loans will be repaired or discharged. However, as a professor, unless the status quo of our political economy and higher education financing changes, I am less optimistic that my students will be free from having a monthly loan payment bill for the rest of their lives. Jeffrey Williams is right. He says, and I quote, "I think we need to talk about student debt more, especially now. We need to talk about it because it affects so many of those in the classroom seats in front of us and because it has increased so precipitously. It is in fact the new paradigm of college funding. Consequently, it is also, or soon will be, the new paradigm of early to middle adult life. Gone are the days when the state university was as cheap as a laptop, considered a right like secondary education. Now it's like most social services, a largely privatized venture, and loans are the way that the individual is frequently paid for it." So the bulk of this work was done while I was at Illinois State University, but now I'm here in the Twin Cities. And a former student at Illinois State University took his own life because of student loan debt, so I dedicated it to Jason Yoder of Normal, Illinois. So I'd like to end by just sharing another brief excerpt that talks about the vocabulary that corporations, we use corporate language within higher education, and to contextualize this $1.4 trillion problem. So Jackie and Ben have alluded to the problem and the of higher education and large corporations, Monsanto and others, and right, education is, the risks are privatized, or the rewards are privatized, and we're having to pay for it. So when you think about $1.4 trillion, how much money is that? It's a large amount of money. How much did the banks get bailed out? How many trillions? I think it was like $16 trillion. So that just shows the mass amount of money that's embedded in here. So I argue, and my colleagues argue, that we need a new language, a new lexicon, and that's where I'd like to enter here and conclude. We concur with Massey, who writes, "The vocabulary we use to talk about the economy in particular has been crucial to the establishment of neoliberal hegemony. Neoliberal higher education relies and naturalizes a lingua franca that is homo economicus and financialized. And after neoliberalism, the Kilbourn Manifesto, Hall, Massey, and Rustin in 2015 document how neoliberalism normalizes a capitalist lexicon and language that is dehumanizing. For instance, considering the following neoliberal higher education terms: productivity, efficiency, financial aid, leveraging synergies, outsourcing, chief academic officer, austerity, growth, strategic planning, capacity, return on investment, human capital, accountability, affordability, the knowledge economy, and the list goes on. My favorite is estimated family contribution." I don't think you can get smaller than zero. Well, I guess you can, negative numbers. So under the neoliberal finance model of higher education, the college student is a consumer, no matter where she or he hails from or attends college. In 2010, when federal financial aid policy moved back to direct lending by the federal government to cut out the middleman after 45 years of federally guaranteed student loans from the private sector at market rates, the private lending market extended its reach to international students interested and able to pay for a degree from a U.S. college or university. As Massey states, "The message underlying this use of the term customer for so many different kinds of human activities that in all or almost all of our daily activities, we are operating as consumers in a market. And this truth has been brought in not by chance, but through managerial instruction and the thoroughgoing renaming of institutional practices." In the book, we talk about how white supremacy is the DNA of neoliberalism. And I'm gonna end with these brief quotes. And it forbids speaking truth to power. So, in his Race and Origins of American Neoliberalism, Hull states the following, and I quote, "The language of neoliberalism was the result of the white response to the black struggle for civic inclusion. The language of neoliberalism is organized around the white private / black public binary. White private defined the market and the economic policy that benefited business as white and superior." Hull goes on to write, "Whites resented spending their tax dollars on blacks. The preferred method of maintaining white power became exercising white control over state budgets. Austerity freed whites from the economic burden of establishing racial equality." And so as higher education becomes more privatized and inaccessible, folks of color, even poor whites, have to secure financing through alternative means. And those channels are debt. But what happens when the bills start coming in? Perhaps they don't have a job, they don't have assets, they become debt slaves. So that's a precarious situation that we find ourselves in. Thank you.
Professor Eckrich from Illinois State University.
So I think I will try, for the sake of time and some discussion, because there have been some pretty powerful presentations already, I want to keep my comments brief. But I think a question in it for all of us is understanding why. Why is a privatization of public education going on? why is a privatization of our military going on? Why is a privatization of many, many public resources going on? And my work over, you know, almost 20 years now has kind of been grappling with that question. And my adult life led me into doing graduate studies, and I worked on the question of value. What is the nature of value in these sort of disparate ways that we use the concept? Economic value, ethical values, moral values, and values in education. And there was a whole movement in the 80s and 90s of values clarification in education. And that study, I was most really interested in the underpinnings, the economic underpinnings of value. And what that work led me to, basically, was studying the nature of exchange relations and what mediates our exchange relations in a means of exchange, something we know today as money. And I found my way to studying sort of the history of monetary theory, monetary history, empirical history, and found a flaw, really, in the way in which modern economy created a partnership between really renegade merchant bankers and the old aristocracy that created a partnership that began the founding of modern banking, in it being rooted in a private issuance of our public money. And it began as a very gradual process, and there were laws in England, and you know, there's a long history, and one of the texts that I finally read cover to cover last summer after owning it for 10 years and reading it piecemeal gives that history over a 2,000-year period of time. And I'm here at this conference with members of the organization that the author of this book, Stephen Zarlinga, founded. It's called the American Monetary Institute. And basically, at the heart of our exchange relations should be a public money that is spent into circulation for the public good, to act as a medium of exchange, a transaction lubricant for our exchange relations. And instead, gradually, through fits and starts, it wasn't a given ever in the first 200 years, but that process was institutionalized in the United States in 1913, and that gave away the responsibility of the government to create our money and regulate the value thereof to the private banking sector completely. And so in doing that, and I'm going to talk about this a bit more in a later session, but in doing that, the government gave away its resources as well. It didn't only give away ours, it gave out, it made itself beholden to the private bankers. And that's part of where our student loan debt problem comes from, because as the federal government got into student loans, it didn't start with grants. It didn't have the money for grants. It started with loans. And it couldn't even give loans, and I'll tell that story later completely. It changed the process so that it was a private banker's giving the loan at twice the interest rates that the government loans have been. And that process has gone on. We're more beholden to the banks because the government has us to come to for taxes if it doesn't go to the bankers, or it has the land that it stole away from the Native Americans, you can sell that off. So it has a couple other means, but we are beholden entirely to the bankers for all our money. And The ironic thing, I want to comment just briefly on public K-12 education. I'm a professor of in a college of education, so I'm preparing students for teaching K-12 education. And the privatization of the public school system that is increasingly going on is an ironic monetization of the public purse. That that is, you know, public schools, and the one I would recommend, a film called Education Inc., a recent film, and it looks at the study in Colorado, a school district, Douglas, Colorado, but a half billion dollar budget in this school district is a cash cow for private education corporations, and it's refilled every year. And that's part of why it's a big growth market for a private sector. And it leaves, it's at the expense of the regular public schools that aren't charter schools, and it's undermining the public school district's boards that are, you know, there's a whole role of ALEC in the what is it called, the American Legislative Exchange?
Council.
I mean, the word exchange there is really creepy. But the laws that are being infiltrated across states to allow the privatization of the public schooling system is just one more form. And so I think getting to the source of that, in my understanding, is to understand that we have a mistaken, a flawed monetary system that that if we correct that by bringing the power to create money back into the federal government where it belongs, as the very nature of what money is, and that money, that the government is the one that spends money into circulation for the public good, and when it ends up in the banks, their role is to provide the checkings and loans and saving services for already existing money, money that is public money, not private interest debt-based money. And I think the example of public schools being taken over, school boards being taken over, the same as the corporate taking over of our military. And those are, you know, my dissertation led me to the work of Jane Jacobs. Some of you may know her, it sounds like. But what her text, Systems of Survival, looks at the moral foundations of commerce and politics. And she talks about that they make sense as ways of making a living, two ways, and there are moral precepts that guide each of those two ways. The problems come when the two ways are coherent and consistent internal in themselves, but there are contradictions across them. One is the trading way of making a living, or commercial. The other is the guardian way of making a living, or that she calls it the taking way of making a living. And the problem is when you mix and match precepts across the two. And our modern banking, I think, is what she would call, she uses the term monstrous moral hybrid. Or systemic moral corruption, when you mix across these moral precepts for these two different, guardian work is not commercial work. And commercial work, that's where actually scientific work and educational work actually belong within the nature of commercial work, dissent for the sake of the task, innovation. And I could read you the set of precepts, but I don't want to take the time now. But I think that understanding the contradiction, the flaw at the heart of our exchange relations, which are in modern money as private interest debt-driven money, understanding that and writing that, which we can do. Legislation has already been introduced to do it. It's a matter of the public understanding it and understanding how we can transition and doing the bottom-up work from school boards to municipal governments, to state governments, to federal governments, to push federal legislators to change at the national level. Let me stop there for the sake of time.
So we'll stay over here at this point. Thank you so much. Covered a lot of territory. Let's take up to 5 hands, and you can be a question or a comment. Let's try to keep them to 30 seconds if we can. That will give time to bring it back up here and respond, and maybe we'll even have a little bit more, so we'll see. And while, after I take the hands, I'm actually going to get out a sheet of paper, a sign-up sheet. So if anybody who has not signed in to this conference yet would like to be on a list to follow up and exchange information, you can sign in as well by signing on that sheet. So I see 1, 2, where's that? 1, 2, Nancy, right? Do you still have your hand up? Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then we'll go 6. So let's keep them to 30 seconds. We'll get 6 in. And so just remember your number. Let's go.
My one?
Yep.
Okay. This is kind of a sociological question. Just a quick comment as an older timer. I'm just wondering, I hate to use this analogy as a vegan, but the concept of boiling a frog, you have to do it very slowly. And I'm wondering if Gen Xers today are aware of how bad things have gotten, or if it's just so slow that they're not aware. When I was in grad school, we had a professor who took some funding from ONR, and he was shunned.
Right.
I had no student debt. I went to a private college, it was free tuition. And I'm just wondering, what's happening in campuses? Why are we seeing protests? I know it's kind of bubble-proof because you can't declare bankruptcy now. What's happening sociologically?
Great, thank you. 2.
I'm going to pass.
Okay, good modeling. 3. Yeah.
I've heard that the amount of student loan debt is almost equal to the housing debt in 2008, and that the default rate is just about there as well. What should my 25-year-old daughter, who has been deferring her student loan, do?
Great question. Okay, 2 great questions. Number 4.
Yeah, mine's a comment.
Okay,
I worked for many years in a Wall Street bank, and I've studied the money system. And one good. Based on my experience working in a Wall Street bank and other experiences, my comment is this: it's very, if the public corporation, if it's publicly traded, like Monsanto. You can go, anyone can go on the internet to the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and they give you the balance sheet of that public corporation. And just copy it to a Word document and then search for long-term debt. And you can see the billions of dollars that private commercial banks have loaned to that institution. And generally, I've done it multiple times investigating, generally it's about 40% of the worth of that institution. That is a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
So the power of those corporations can be traced right back to the banking system and how they create the money.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Number 5.
Yeah, earlier you had commented that there seems to be some corporations are maybe against some of the higher education, and I was just curious about, I mean, we can guess why that might be, but I was just wondering what the obvious answer is.
Why they wanted to restructure it, asking. Yeah, exactly. Okay, great. Number 6.
Mine is more of a comment. You'll probably know more about it. Yes Magazine did a whole debt issue, and in challenging our debts, which go beyond student debt, the legal term odious debt, debt put upon citizens by their government that in no way benefits the people, that that's a concept we should use because they get us so many ways.
Great point. So that was number six. I think I started to see a hand, so since we went quickly, and people here were all writing notes.
Can I just ask you to clarify, are you saying odious debt can be forgiven, or we can
ask? Well, actually, the article, and Yes Magazine did a whole issue on debt, and it's open source, so you can go directly there. They were looking at talking about a debt strike, and so that was a term that they brought up.
Coming out of the common law tradition. Great, thank you. I'm going to take a couple more, and that way, then when we respond, that will sort of wrap it, and we won't miss anybody. So we've got one, two. Here, go ahead.
All right, so one of the things I wanted to understand, like, what is the issue associated with college board? Like, you mentioned there's an arms race going on. So as a citizen or a student, like, what type of university should I support? Is it community colleges, or am I forced the choice to go to these expensive places?
Thank you.
Jacqueline, could you just remind me of the term that you were using for the offsets?
So yes, it's offset trade or counter trade. They make up this obscure term the technical term is called offset trade.
Yeah. I think that whole relationship that you were describing is very interesting because there's the beginnings of a new campaign to shut down U.S. foreign bases overseas. And your information seems to me really crucial to that. So I'd like to talk a bit more
good.
About that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. So that's great. So thank you for excellent questions and comments. And Nancy and Jackie are actually in one of the next sessions, too, where they'll be honing in on some of these questions. More specifically, and then there'll be some other sessions as well that you'll obviously see in the program. I'm happy to respond to a couple of these, but I'm also happy to have somebody else go first if there's somebody who's itching.
I would say I think you're the boiling frog question that college students today, except for the minority, but a vocal and strong minority that are involved in the Black Lives Matter movement and the immigration struggles, are living their lives in warm water. You know, they are unaware of how hot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're aware of how hot it is because they're working. I mean, I take data from my students. They're working, many of them, 30 hours a week, plus a full load, a full academic load. And as a professor, you're expecting to actually facilitate education from students who, you know, start studying at maybe 9 o'clock, not because they're out partying. Anyhow, so...
There's an outrage.
Yeah, the majority don't, you know, they're just struggling to survive. And so I do think they're not aware of how hot it is. I want to answer just the other question about what to tell a student who's deferring loans. Work on monetary reform. Seriously, because part of the possibility of the NEED Act passing is to be able to spend money into circulation to discount previous student loans, if that's the public will. And the issue of whether education is a public good or a private good, that has informed, you know, the whole background of federal money being spent on education. We are one of the few countries, many countries have free higher education. And so I think that will be possible if that's the political will, given monetary reform. The means for doing it is there. It won't happen overnight. It won't happen if the democracy doesn't ask for it. We don't make it happen. But the possibility for it exists, which doesn't today. And it's un... what's the term that you're... It's unforgivable student debt. There's another term for it.
Dischargeable.
Non-dischargeable. And so that she has that the rest of her life. They will tap her Social Security if she hasn't paid it by then. And the percentage of people whose Social Security is being tapped for student loan debt is on the rise, obviously. So I think working on monetary reform is the answer to that one. And I'll stop there.
I have a quick follow-up to that, and then another response to that from. So the an assistant in my department told me that there's a program that was begun under Obama that if you work for a nonprofit,
right,
that you
New
can
York's.
Pay back. So I didn't know about that, and maybe you can share details about that with other students, but that seems like it might be a nice option. Well, the thing is, it seems a little screwy because he's, you know, got a regular bureaucratic job at Northwestern, and he's able to get this special rate for being working at a nonprofit.
But I would say in relation to that, the first students who've gone through that and should be at the point of 10 years paying and having it forgiven are now, there's discrepancy
right.
on whether the organization that they're working for actually
yeah.
qualifies
wow.
as not
right.
profit.
Yeah. You have to
Whoa.
Set that up in
and
the beginning.
Yeah. Well, but the law was nebulous
oh.
as to what would count and what doesn't. And
oh,
now
wow.
it's being questioned.
Yes.
Okay.
So you really have to be very careful.
Yeah.
And there are proposals out there for free two-year college education that's and what that, an F2CO, you can look it up, it's called that, free two-year college option. But the means for paying it totally question the neoliberal nature of our higher ed funding system, because that has, from the get-go, gone to Northwestern, gone to University of Chicago, gone to all the private liberal arts and Ivy League schools at the public expense. Those have been subsidized. And also, you know, to the public schools. And that will be a big shift, a larger portion. A large portion goes to private schools, much larger than it should in relation to the population.
So let's take
I think
one. Just because we're almost out of time, I want to give you a minute, Nicholas and myself, and then we'll.
I was just going to say that one of the problems also is that there's been a big shift in the ratio of tenured faculty to untenured
right.
faculty,
right.
and there's this new, you know, the thing that happened to me is the new tactic du jour, which is basically firing people
right.
and not. Regardless of whether they have tenure, because then you're forced to go to court and sue to get your job back, and there are no attorney fees. So the worst that happens is that you get compensated for your lost salary, which is nothing. And what most people do is they sign settlements and go away, and you don't hear about it. I only found out about this when I put this blog up. But it's happening quite a bit, and it's happening to people who are exercising academic speech.
Quick one, Ben.
Let's go to because we're almost out of time. I want to give Nicholas a chance to respond.
I think the generational folk, the younger folk, myself included, we do notice because the rules are different. And I see that in not just corporate America, because now certain jobs are offering fringe benefits, such as you get a certain amount of money to pay off your student loans. Like, that's the carrot they're saying. Oh, come to our bank and work for us because we'll give you this you know, allowance to use, if you will. But I think another area, we talk about tuition growth and we've talked about corporations. What about the textbook companies? Some research by Pergs are really showing that that's accelerated vastly faster than tuition. And they're getting very clever, right? The codes, you have to use it one time, you can't sell it and recycle it to another student. What complicity do faculty have in that? Perhaps faculty are even publishing in those books and are benefiting perhaps on a, you know, a kickback of percentage on royalties.
Offer you.
That's why there's also a movement for open textbooks.
Correct. So that gets to my second point that I'll end on, that in terms of what colleges and institutions should you support, or where should you go if you're younger. I would now say, and I know it can be challenging because of the transfer credits, But here in Minnesota, we have a good pathway to transfer community college to four-year. I would do a lot of credits at the two-year and transfer in, get your degree at the four-year. But this whole notion of affordability, I think, if we take our eyes off the prize of, well, why are the costs of things accelerating, like textbooks? I work now at an MSI, Minority Serving Institution. I'll tell you one thing. We stretch a dollar a lot farther than at a more predominantly white institution does. And so I would support a minority serving institution or a two-year college now than I would. But students, they know, you know, they go to a school because of the name.
Yep. So just finally, in terms of this question around, you know, are Xers and Xennials and Millennials aware? I think they are very much aware in the sense that Lucille was talking about. But I do want to draw attention to the mobilizations around this issue. I mean, in addition to the Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter and the Dreamers and so on, you have the Million Student March, these major mobilizations in recent years across college campuses calling for free public higher education and for student debt relief. I want to also draw attention to the fact that those demands were demands that we started to issue in the 1990s and were very much on the margins. We couldn't get sort of major student organizations to adopt them. And it took many years of the Books Not Bombed student strikes in 2003, and then the tent state universities, which, you know, were a pre-Occupy, which also got raided and attacked and brutalized on college campuses with students and faculty coming together. So just recognize the agency of successive generations and figuring out what's going on. I do think that the piece that I think most of us are not aware of has more to do with sort of the engines and the drivers, some of the things that we talked about here, of the increase in higher ed costs and tuition. So for example, I was shocked to find out that in the 1920s, it was illegal for the University of Wisconsin to accept any private money at all, right? That's how far we've gone. So we need to relearn our history. We need to learn that corporations, whether they're private or public, are publicly chartered. Every corporation is a state entity. Right. Northwestern exists by the will of the people, right? It belongs to us. Marquette belongs to us. We need to take them back. We need to have a broader agenda. So excellent discussion. We'll have a plenary at the end of the day where we talk about action. So make sure to come to that. And thank you. Thanks to our panelists. Thanks to all of you for great questions. Are you not from the